Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to our program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Matt James, President and CEO of the Center for the Next Generation. The Center for the Next Generation is a new California-based policy research and communications organization that is focused on sustainable energy and the environment, children and family issues, and California's economy and budget. We are happy to be able to partner with the Kaiser Family Foundation, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, to bring you tonight's event. I'd particularly like to thank Drew Altman, the president of the Kaiser Family Foundation, for providing us with this wonderful venue at the Foundation's Quadras Conference Center. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's outstanding panel. Robert Atkinson is the founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Prior to founding ITIF, Robert was vice president of the Progressive Policy Institute, director of PPI's Technology and New Economy Project, and executive director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. He was appointed by President Clinton to the Commission on Workers, Communities, and Economic Change in the New Economy, and was a member of the Task Force on National Security in the Information Age. His new book, The Global Race for Innovation Advantage and Why the U.S. is Falling Behind, will be published later this year. Senator Mark Warner was elected to the United States Senate in 2008 and is a member of the Senate's Banking, Budget, Commerce, and Rules Committees. He co-founded the cellular phone company Nextel, and after 20 years as a business leader, served as governor of Virginia from 2002 to 2006. In those four short years, Senator Warner turned record deficits into budget surpluses and was named by Time magazine as one of America's best five governors, and Virginia was nationally recognized by Time as best managed state. Whaley Dye is co-founder and vice president and general manager of Communications and Computing Businesses Unit for Marvell Technology Group. She is the only woman co-founder of a global semiconductor company and the driving force behind the company's civic activities and helping expand technology access in the developing world, particularly in the areas of education and green technology. Prior to co-founding Marvell, Whaley was involved in a software development and project management at Canon Research America Incorporated. Last year, the Sudarja Dye Hall, which was supported by Whaley, opened at the University of California, Berkeley, and is home to the Center for Information Technology Research in the Interest of Society. The center's mission is to help create information technology solutions for our most pressing social, environmental, and health concerns. And moderating tonight's program is Steve Wright, Vice President of Strategic Communications at Silicon Valley Leadership Group. Prior to joining Silicon Valley Leadership Group, Steve was an award-winning reporter and editor at the San Jose Mercury News. And now, let me turn to Steve for tonight's program.
Thank you, Matt. It's a privilege to moderate tonight's panel, Reversing the U.S. Innovation Decline, What the U.S. Economy Needs for the Next Decade. Obviously, it's a big subject, and we don't have much time, so we'll jump right in. I'd like to start off first with Senator Warner. I think lots of us in Silicon Valley would be a little bit surprised that the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation report showed that the U.S. was dead last when it comes to innovation-based competitiveness. We think that because Silicon Valley kind of operates in its own orbit, and clearly, when you live in Silicon Valley and two companies that weren't even in the phone business 5 years ago and are now dominating that field, it's hard for us to relate sometimes to the rest of the country. I wonder if you could take just a minute and put the innovation competitiveness deficit issue in perspective for us.
Well, thank you, Steve. And let me thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting this and folks at Kaiser for giving us this venue. I do have to acknowledge it pained me a bit since I was the co-founder of Nextel when you urged everyone to turn their cell phones off. I'm the only politician who likes to have the cell phones actually ring when I'm talking, especially now that I'm a federal employee. But I think that if we look at the last decade, and Rob Atkinson has got some pretty stunning data, and he can address this problem as well, that while we acknowledge there are the outliers, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Twitters, this last decade has seen very little in terms of major innovation, nothing approaching the late 80s and through the bulk of the 90s. And I think there are a series of problems that has compounded that. It's a failure to have an appropriate, truly 21st century education system. It is the failure of our country to really move forward on meaningful immigration reform, from H-1B to the whole notion of how we continue to attract the best and brightest around the world. I think there may be parts of the reason why innovation, particularly in terms of early stage startup companies, is even harder. That has been compounded by technology, because if you can now move capital without barriers or boundaries, oftentimes it's a lot easier to, with the flick of a key switch, move hundreds of billions of dollars in an overnight trade for 10 basis points, as opposed to the very hard work of early stage capital formation to start companies. And I think that question of early stage capital formation has to be, while here in the Valley still is pretty successful in a host of other areas around the country, has really fallen aside. I think that, and we will let the others address this issue as well, but there is a host of things we can do from the macro standpoint around education, around immigration, around basic R&D, but there are a series of sub-issues that we're also going to have to confront. The failure of our government to efficiently allocate spectrum so that we can really see major movements forward in mobile communications and mobile broadband, which is an enormous growth area. We're making sure that we have a smoother regulatory process. If we think about the fact it shouldn't take 13 years and $1 billion to get any drug to market, and part of that is due to an antiquated FDA approval process. The failure to protect intellectual property, again, with an outdated and outmoded PTO that needs a dramatic reinvestment and reinvention. And ultimately, we're going to have to take on all these issues in a worldwide macroeconomic context where, as recently as 15 or 20 years ago, the rest of the world had to wait for America to get its economic act together for the rest of the world to be successful. We all know that China, India, and even Brazil, they are no longer waiting for us to get our economic act together. They are moving ahead with their own competitiveness agenda, and we're going to have to do that as well. And in a context of fiscal constraints due to our deficit that is going to make this challenge, I think, greater than any time in our history.
Great, thank you. And we're going to get into some of those issues, education, immigration, and so forth, in just a couple of minutes. Rob, I'd like to start with you, or go next to you. Local CEO Bill Watkins of BridgeLex, who many folks here may know, often says that the federal government's effort to help the U.S. compete with other companies has brought a knife to a gunfight. And so I'd like to ask you, in your view, whether Senator Warner's colleagues in the Senate and in the House and in the current administration really get the innovation economy and global competition and what CEOs are dealing with here.
Well, Senator Warner does.
Yep.
Good answer.
I'm smart enough to know that. He actually does. Look, I don't think it's not just a question of Washington gets it. It's a question of the intelligentsia generally in this country that I would argue don't get it. You ask many, many people, you look at many of the media stories, you talk to many of the pundits, talk to most of the economists, and they will say things like, look, America's number one, we've always been number one, we're always going to be number one, because, and then they rattle off a list of things. We're the most entrepreneurial, we're the most open, we're the most market-based. We are those things, but that's not enough anymore, and we're not number one. So we actually, the study you cited, the Atlantic Century that we wrote recently, showed that of 40 countries, we ranked 40th in progress over the last decade, progress on factors like the number of new startups, the amount of venture capital, the amount of corporate R&D, the amount of government R&D, the amount of scientists and engineers. Let me just sort of mention two quick statistics that I think are telling. The federal government keeps a record of what's called capital stock. So they, by industry, they measure how much capital stock an industry has. So how many machines, how many computers, how much software. And if you look at what happened in the decade of the 90s, this last decade, excuse me, it went up 38% in the country. Pretty good. It only went up 6% in manufacturing, though. And that's the lowest by far in any decade in American history. I'm going to tell you the two industries that had the fastest growth of capital stock in America in this last decade. One was the mutual fund industry, and the other was the sports stadium industry. So we built sports stadiums while we were looking at our 401ks, but we weren't investing in real economic growth and the engines of the future. You can say, well, that's manufacturing, that's not the valley. Well, you look at, for example, what we've done on IT R&D, R&D in the IT industry. According to the OECD, that has dropped 50% over the last decade as a share of GDP. And then you look at countries like Finland, it's up 73%, Korea, it's up 67%. So when you look around the country, around the world, what you see are country after country who have national innovation strategies. That includes on the tax side as well as on the investment side. And they're putting those in place because they want to win. And I think the fundamental problem we have in the U.S. is we really don't think we're in competition. And if we do think we're in competition, we think we're the Chicago Bulls of 1998. Mm-hmm. And that we can beat anybody. And the reality is we're probably more like the Washington Wizards of 2011. not quite that bad, but...
Thank you very much. Wei Li, you have, as a co-founder of a Silicon Valley company that has been doing quite well, how do you see it from your perspective when it comes to international competition and what the U.S. is doing right or wrong?
Well, I've been here for 31 years. I was born in Shanghai, came here for education, so went to high school for 1 year and then went to UC Berkeley. Great education from U.S. That's why my husband and I were very focusing on giving back, helping school, and things like that. I'm very hopeful, even though all the data and this, I think we're still the best, I mean, U.S. I'll tell you why, because U.S., or especially this area with the weather, everything, you know, very dynamic, I think, you know, to me, this is like a small world. I think the only subtle piece I think we need to improve is make sure we continue to invest in education, research, because the landscape of I call the racetrack is very different. 30 years ago, U.S., from all angles, way ahead, you know, from technology standpoint of view, innovation, in terms of resource, guess what? All the best, smartest people from U.S. and from around the world, they come to this valley to start some technology innovation. And then also the third piece, environment. If you look at why Silicon Valley is so successful, everybody starts company here. Used to people say each month maybe hundreds of companies try to register some kind of startup. The reason is you got the VC here. Well, this is Sand Hill Road, you know, the VC, right? You got the, and then you got research center, top schools here, and the talents from around the world like this beautiful weather. This roof reminds me of somewhere you see in Hawaii, some hotel, you know. But everything is kind of like positive for us to make a success here. And this myself is a one example, right? Came here, speaks almost no English, okay, very little, and today be able to as a co-founder build a top three fabulous semiconductor in the world. That's to everybody that's dream come to true. Now, easy to say, but there's a lot of work, hard work behind that. And it's not just the three co-founders. It's the teamwork, the 6,000 people that I have around the world made that happen. And we're very proud because if you have BlackBerry, you've got PCs, anything you name it, Cisco system, the switches, networking system, and the latest, coolest thing called Connect, Xbox, got my technology inside, right? So it's pretty much we're serving everywhere for all the high-tech industry. But I think we really need to make sure that learn what U.S. has done the best because the competition is very tough. China, I was born in China, right? China has a lot of resource. 30 years ago, the perception was China poor country, but today is a rich country, right? You look at the resource, then back to the formula that worked made the U.S. to be number one 20, 30 years ago, and now China has all these check boxes, right? Resource, very wealthy country, right? The environment is possible. Why? Because in my use example as my industry, semiconductor, in order for us to produce chips, we have to have greatest design, the best mind engineers, but at the same time, we also have to fabricate our design. Well, guess what? In the last 20 years, fabless model was possible because there was a company called TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, right? It's the, used to be you can only produce chip with your own factory, like the Intel, the AMD of the world. But today, anybody can start design house and be able to use outside low-cost fab to make the state-of-the-art technology. Marvell is one example. So it's tough competition, but I'm hopeful. We just need to have more Michael Jordans because I play basketball, so that's what I use. You know, we'll continue to make sure more Michael Jordans, and then we'll get there. A Yao Ming, maybe. And
well, thank you, Weili. And I should mention that I think Rob and Senator Warner also play a little basketball. So
great.
At some point on a trip to Washington,
is there a D.C. basketball court here? Yeah. Maybe we can do a little competition afterwards.
Yeah. Not today. Senator Warner, of course, the innovation, of course, is not always about technology, always about tech. Rob mentioned about how poorly manufacturing jobs have fared in the U.S. economy. But there was a story today that manufacturing jobs are starting to creep back up with the U.S. auto industry. What needs to be done, would you say, to address some of the other areas of the economy to spur innovation?
Well, I think, let's take manufacturing first. I think some folks have got the sense that we no longer can compete on a manufacturing field. And I just don't accept it. I mean, if you look at Germany's response to this recent downturn, Germany has higher taxes, more unions, and as much, if not more, regulation than we do. Yet their recovery has been driven by advanced manufacturing sector. Part of where we fall down is in our education system, recognizing that we need an education system, yes, that produces engineers and doctors and scientists, but we need an education system that also produces plumbers and electricians and technicians. And we have an education system that is almost entirely geared towards a four-year degree, which is the pinnacle, as opposed to industry certifications, career and technical education, and putting validation behind that. When I was governor, we had a program that started to take any non-college-bound student and guarantee them an industry certification along with a high school diploma, and if they didn't finish it by the end of their 12th year, we'd give them a free semester at the community college to finish it. You add about $5,000 to $8,000 in immediate earning power, and you take a workforce in a sector like manufacturing where there are still a number of jobs going unfilled because of lack of quality workers, one. Two, we have to be careful. We, Weili, I think, appropriately highlighted a lot of the incredible opportunities here in Silicon Valley, but the rest of the country is not all like Silicon Valley. And part of the promise of the Internet, part of the promise of a network world 20 years ago was you can build it anywhere. You can show you can build it in Shanghai now. You can show you can build it in Bangalore. What we've not done a good job at is showing you can build it in rural California and rural America. And you will not be able to be competitive on some of the mid-tech industries unless you finish broadband deployment. And there are examples. Again, we can cite some around the country where you've got to have tax structure, but the infrastructure in place to at least be kind of in the game around broadband. And I think that's around a series of industries, not just manufacturing, but mid-tech, back office operations. So I think there are opportunities, but it is going to take acknowledging what Rob said, that the rest of the world, just because we had economic supremacy in the 20th century does not mean that we're going to have in the 21st. Now, there may be a billion people in China and a billion people in India that want our jobs, but they also should be able to buy our stuff. And unless we think about a export-driven economy going forward, and that cuts across all industry, then we're not going to maintain the standards of the 20th century. And final point I'd like to make, and I say this with some trepidation as a guy who was a VC beyond being a founder of Nextel, the last decade, the one sector, with the exception of, let's say, so around some of the social networking areas, the one sector where we did have a lot of innovation was the financial sector. And it was, a misfortune that the best and the brightest no longer came to Silicon Valley or our high-tech quarter in Northern Virginia, and instead used all that intellectual capital to create a whole series of new financial products that were supposed to be about lowering the cost of risk, when in reality they created a financial house of cards that almost brought the whole country and the world to the brink. So, one idea of creating a few more engineers that actually build stuff rather than simply create financial products would be a bit of kind of the ethos we need to have.
Good. Thank you. And I think Wei Li would say we also need to have good weather throughout the United States.
I was doing some pictures in Minnesota today, let me assure you.
In Minnesota, oh my. Rob, I want to talk just a little bit, or have you talk just a little bit, if you would, about the recovery. We talked about manufacturing jobs being up a little bit, but the recovery and the kind of the anemic nature of it. What do you see are the underlying structural factors affecting our economy right now, especially the ones that impact technology-based companies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at sort of what the conventional wisdom of the financial crisis, it's a little bit akin to sort of a Category 5 hurricane that just sort of came out because the Gulf was hot and it hit us and it destroyed a lot of value and we'll end up recreating that. I really think that's wrong. I think a lot of what was behind the financial crisis was that there was a surfeit of real investment opportunities in this last decade compared to what we had in the 90s and the 80s. We had less CapEx. We had a stagnation of corporate R&D. We had a low growth of venture, actually a decline of venture. So it was really, I think, what happened was there was a lot of capital coming into this country looking for good investments. It didn't have good investments because we didn't have the supply side of investments. And that, in my view, was one of the reasons we had the financial crisis. It's exactly the same reason why the recovery is so anemic, I would argue. The recovery will be, on record, the most anemic recovery in American history, mm-hmm. by far, when it comes to jobs. The GDP is a little different, but when it comes to jobs. And part of the reason for that is, and I would argue part of the reason for that is, how many people in this room and honestly will say in 2020 the U.S. economy is going to be much, much better, much more vibrant, and have a much better economic engine than it did in 2010? And I think fundamentally the reason why corporations are sitting on $2 trillion of cash $200 billion, is because they...
$2 trillion.
Because they just don't trust that the U.S. economy is the engine that it once was, that the investment opportunities are there, so they don't want to jump first because they don't think it's there. So I think a lot of ways it's a question of lack of faith, which is real, and it's a question of lack of real opportunities. And at one point, Senator Warner talked about how important exports are. For every dollar we export out of the U.S., we create twice as many jobs as a dollar of domestic consumption. So we really have to figure out a way to get the U.S. growth engine back on track. That's what's going to get the recovery going, not a lot of these other fiscal and monetary policies. These are sort of Band-Aids that are covering up a much deeper and more serious problem. Now, how we do that is a whole other question, and whether we can do that. But fundamentally, I think if we don't do that, we'll see we'll see 5 to 10 years of very anemic growth and quite slow recovery.
Okay, thank you. Wei Li, I wonder if you would take just a minute to kind of tell people a little bit about your company and how it has fared over the past 3 or 4 years in terms of sales, in terms of hiring, and really what you see maybe going into the next 3 years.
Sure. We have about 6,000 people worldwide, roughly half in U.S., we are a truly global company. We have locations in Europe, for example, 6 locations, Switzerland, Netherlands, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Israel. And in fact, Israel is our second largest R&D center. And then we, of course, have multiple locations in Asia as well, in China, in Singapore, Japan, I look around, if I have to cover every single location, it covers the almost every, more than every 2 weeks I have to be somewhere in the overseas. But I think the key success, I listened to the two leaders here, I think we need to, U.S. need to go global. I mean, U.S. already global, country, but I think we need to focus on global in terms of collaboration, whether the import, export, it needs to be bi-directional. It depends what type of thing we do. But going global is very important because it's the so-called the push and pull, right? Because opportunities, there's a lot of opportunities around the world. From in Asia, for example, today, there are technology they use. I mean, there's the local brand, but when it comes to the brand from U.S., North America, you know, you get just high value. I mean, use smartphone as an example. If you look at the iPhone, right, in China, you can sell multiple times higher than a local brand. So all these things, there's just a lot of leverage point. The U.S., it's a brand name. Now, how do we make sure that we, rather than feel too comfortable and be a little humble, right? And then, because, as I said, the landscape is very, very tough, the competition, because outside U.S., number of countries are very powerful and very capable now. So it's no difference than in my, I call the nerdy industry. You know, you have a competition, right? Marvell used to be zero, nobody, and now number three, Fabulous. But we absolutely every day work just as hard as 15 years ago when we started the company. We have to keep up hard work and work smart and continue to raise the bar. I think, as I say, U.S. very hopeful. Marvell founded in this Silicon Valley, and we absolutely going to do our very best to create a lot of jobs in U.S. as well as jobs outside U.S. for the reason, as I said, you got to be globally successful because only if you do that and you can scale faster and better.
Good. Thank you. You know, I think everybody in Silicon Valley agrees that one of the key elements to the success here, especially in the past couple of decades, has been immigration. And, of course, you're being at the table a successful immigrant, married to a successful immigrant, a good citizen of our country and of our valley. So I wanted to ask Senator Warner a question, because the valley has been trying for years and years to get more educated engineers and scientists, the brightest people in the world, to come here and help create. What do you think the prospects are for immigration reform in Congress, and do you see any solution?
She got Hauser Companies doing it, and I got immigration. Well, listen, it's not just Silicon Valley. You know, we have, in my state, in Northern Virginia, in terms of actual number of tech firms, we rival, a lot of them are kind of IT-related government tech firms, but we rival the Valley. And close to 20% plus are first-generation Americans. This is a critically important issue. I mean, we have been kind of, if anything, we're going in the wrong direction. We clearly need more H-1B visas. We need to raise the caps. We need to make sure that particularly people like Whaley who come here for an education don't get stamped with a do not apply once they graduate from college or graduate school. And it is, the issue has been demagogue. Clearly, you're going to need to secure our borders, but the notion that border security alone is going to deal with the immigration issue. I am not as hopeful that we can get a kind of a H-1B exemption or the proverbial green card with your graduate degree that everyone in the technology industry and many political figures have been talking about for some time. Until we take on, I'm not sure we can do that as a one-off.
Okay.
I think so we are going to have to look at more major immigration reform. And I think that raises some thorny issues, frankly, at the end of the day, about questions about things like, and this was controversial, about questions about identity validation. Because you're going to ultimately have the convergence of healthcare IT, national security, and immigration. And if we don't think about this in a way that's thoughtful and forward-thinking, that has appropriate privacy protections, but allows you to have a system through a credit card-type swipe and check status so that you can cut off the flow of undocumented jobs, then you're never going to really get the political ability, I think, to have a comprehensive immigration reform. And the sooner we can raise those kind of issues in a thoughtful way, the better, because we desperately need more and more ways to supplement, you know, the 300 million Americans to kind of get it right.
So it sounds like we should all be patient.
Well, no, I mean, I think there was a moment in time in the last session, I think it got kind of swept away by other politics, but there is, I think, a growing emergence, and frankly, the business community on this and a host of issues are paper tigers. They are episodic in terms of being involved. Most, again, the general sense, and I say this as somebody who's invested in firms here in this region, and again, made mention of background, you know, many folks in the tech community don't want to mess with politics. It's messy, it's dirty, it's crummy. They're not, folks don't, it, you know, but until you have your voices heard on a regular basis, we're not going to be able to kind of make the changes and the investment in changes and innovation agenda that I think is so desperately needed to make sure that Whaley's positive vision of what our future is becomes reality.
Great. Okay, thank you for that follow-up. Rob, quick question about another long-term issue when it comes to growing and nurturing innovators, which is education, and specifically around the science, technology, engineering, and math components of education for our young people. Your foundation recently released a report on STEM reform, which proposed solutions that are different from the conventional ones most have proposed. Why do you think the current approach to solving the STEM problem is not adequate, and why would your solutions be any better?
Well, first of all, we did this report, I guess, in November of last year on sort of a fresh look at STEM education issues. And I want to thank Intel, who was a supporter of that report. And when we looked at this report, it was with a colleague of mine, Marilee Mayo, who used to be at the National Academy of Sciences, a former chemistry professor. And you really look at the research underlying what matters in terms of kids coming out and ending up with a STEM degree of some kind, a bachelor's of science or beyond. The research actually shows something completely different than what sort of the conventional wisdom is. And I think, and I'll say that in a second, but I think it really goes to a fundamental problem, which is so much of what passes for the right answer in Washington is just largely conventional wisdom that people just keep repeating over and over again. Let me give you a good example of that. The conventional wisdom on STEM, which I'm going to tell you almost everybody says, is that the most important thing we can do in STEM is make sure that teachers who are teaching STEM have a STEM degree. When you really look at the research that's been done on that issue, it really doesn't matter very much. It's a very expensive solution. It's going to cost a lot of money. We're not going to, let's be realistic, in this fiscal environment, we're not going to allocate the money to it. And it really isn't the biggest factor in determining STEM outcomes in schools. So there's a lot of other issues that are...
What's STEM?
I'm sorry. You know, there's actually a poll on STEM, and people thought it was related to vegetables.
Yes.
It's science, technology, engineering, and math education. Sorry, we're in Washington speak all the time. So. And so what we said is, look, the other piece of this, too, which is, you know, it turns out, actually, that there's a recent study that people now, because it's so cheap to do the genome and all, it turns out that there are two occupations that are most related to your genetic makeup, sort of who your parents are determine what you're going to be when you grow up. The two occupations are actually engineers and fine artists. So what that really says is you're a little bit born to be one or the other. In engineering, you know, it's not just like every kid. I could put my son in engineering classes for the rest of his existence. He's not going to be an engineer. So what our proposal was is why not focus more of like an NCAA recruiting model. We do this for kids who are good at football. If we wanted everybody in America to be great at football, we would fail miserably because a lot of people just can't do football. You know, I can do basketball, but I can't do football. So ours was an NCAA recruiting model. Let's identify kids from all spectrums of society early on, identify the ones that are interested and good at it, and then give them the best opportunities. Good example of that, we just proposed a proposal to create 400 new science and math academies in this country, science and math high schools. There's 100 math and science high schools in the country now, and they're one of the most successful places of getting high school kids to do really, really well at STEM, but 100 of them. So the president's proposed, President's PCAST Council, President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, they just proposed creating 200 more of them. So we just need to be thinking more creatively about a lot of these challenges than we have before.
Can I add one thing,
sure.
Rob? I mean, and I think the data did show this. I think this is, you know, again, a good point, because I think Rob is right. The conventional wisdom was you got to get math and science teachers to actually have a background in math and science. And this was, I think his report was very enlightening on this. But we also have, and I think the data didn't contradict this, tell me if it did, that where we lose a lot of our kids is we lose girls and children of color in middle school from math and science. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and unless you can kind of, with an increasingly diverse America, unless you can kind mm-hmm. of erase those trends, it really becomes, some of it's policy, some of it's just plain numbers.
No, that's interesting. And I myself am a failure at math, but I'm very proud of the fact that I had a good English teacher. let's stick on education for just a second more, because I want to ratchet it up a bit in terms of technology. And this one would be for you, Wei-Li. The mobile technology is now just really starting to get into education. I mean, we thought we were all set once we got laptops in the classroom, but mobile technology is right around the corner. But there's always the price and the teacher training that remain challenges for this kind of thing. Wei-Li, how do you think mobile technology can drive innovation in the schools?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, life is mobile. We all know, right? We carry a phone, tablet, laptop, you name it. And then in the future, what I envision is all this wall, the beautiful art, is all going to be live, and you have fish going through, maybe create a fish tank, has this background. You know, everything is going to be real live contents. It's going to be smart furnishing. It's all the data, video, contents. You can communicate across the globe. Now, that's just talking about in general. Now let's go into the education part. I think everything we do, passion is number one. Why certain kids love to study longer, others, they don't want to, because some got more passion. So we need to create tools to, you know, allow them to be able to create their passion and love for education, right? And, when I have two sons now, both are college, one study PhD, the other one third year college. But when they were little, I allowed them to play video games, because as long as it's not too much, because playing video game is a way, a certain type of tools to train them to be, you know, thinking faster, and rather than taking a typing class, they have to type on their little device, right? So coordination and all of those. So I think in general, since this is a technology age of this new century, we are the tools are available now. As a semiconductor leader, we try to make it so affordable. And not only those hardware or devices affordable, and make it so easy to use, and create a lot of education type of applications so that kids can afford, and they know how to. In the classroom, teacher and kids can communicate. So using tablet as example, a lot of time, classroom, you cannot bring any devices. But if you have a little mobile server, like we create a little plug computer, we call it, mm-hmm. and then that can allow a teacher to load contents. so they can put special security and filter, you know, have a filter to go through the contents, make sure that's what they want to use for the class material, and then themselves with a tablet teacher and students. And this way, it's a lot more productive, because when I was little, I remember teachers Xerox multiple copies and, you know, tons of, you know, very heavy and always mistakes and this. So now all these have becomes real, you know, real time, right? Efficiency, right? And make
right. And I think it'll be important for students to not just use their mobile device for texting out of class, but actually use it as a way to gain knowledge.
Right. Just there's all sophisticated tool today available. We can make it so that all these mobile connected device can be used just like the whiteboard or paper handouts that the traditional way in the past, right?
Okay, great, thank you. Senator Warner, this next question is from a member of the audience. And of course, this being Silicon Valley, I don't think we could get through a Q&A without talking about patent reform. Patents are a big part of innovation. It's a big part of protecting your intellectual property. But now it takes about 3 years to process and review an application. What do you think can be done on this issue in order to help competitiveness?
I think let me give you three specific suggestions. One is, and this is relatively low-hanging fruit, and from a dollar invested versus output, increasing the number and quality of the patent examiners at the patent trade office. You know, when we think about the time it takes and reviewing the revolving door we have at the PTO right now, where young folks come for a couple years and then can make 5x on the outside, who wants to stay and get the expertise to stay within the patent trade office? This is, and again, this is an area that in the kind of rush to be anti-government on all costs, this is the ultimate kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face, number one. Number two, you know, and there have been, it is challenging to kind of, Congress doesn't wrestle very good with intellectual property protection issues. And to put it lightly. And how we have an appropriate regime to kind of sort through protecting intellectual property in a way that doesn't tilt the balance too much against the entrepreneur, too much in favor of the large companies. It's still, you know, it would be best, and there are a couple times in the past where we got close to kind of an industry-wide deal. If we could find an industry-wide solution set that could be then brought to the legislative approach, it would be better than kind of wrangling this through the normal political process. Two last points. One is, when we think about intellectual property, I believe very much one of the great areas that has not anywhere near met the potential that we all hoped or expected was life sciences. And whether it's pharma or medical devices, it has been, I think, an underperformer for some time. And part of that is due to the fact that our FDA process, separate from our intellectual property process, is pretty broken. And then finally, you know, we also, and this is where we have to be, I think, find common cause with other industrial nations around the world, we have to be much, much more aggressive about intellectual property piracy, particularly from China. China has been an enormous, I think, kind of abuser of, we will take your property, or the price of doing business in China is not ability to create truly independent content. They want to own, control. We do need to make sure that we have a more level trading a relationship with China, and that part of that goes to intellectual property protection.
Mm-hmm. And just quickly build on what Senator Warner said. We have a blog called the Innovation Policy Blog, which is just innovationpolicy.org. And we have a blog post today. One of my colleagues has been over in Ghana for the last 6 months helping the Ghanaian government with its Ghanaian government with its tech strategy. And he was talking with a firm, a small firm over there that has developed a very cool device that is sort of a mobile device related to home security, which is a big problem over there. And he did all, he's a fabulous company, did all the design all, and went and worked with a Chinese company to get the manufacturing done. And he found about 6 months later that the Chinese manufacturer was actually selling the product in China without paying any royalties, totally inappropriate. And so it's one thing to steal IP from us. We're rich, right? But now they're stealing IP from a country that is actually five times poorer than they are. And it just, you know, it's just to me outrageous. Here's this poor young guy, he's like 30-year-old engineer, who's come up with an idea. He was in a small business incubator. He's gotten funding. He's trying to build a company. And yet even this guy gets his intellectual property stolen from him. So we have to really step up to the plate and build alliances around the world with the Europeans and with others who respect this intellectual property. And it's not just China. I don't want to say it's just China. India does this. A lot of other countries, Brazil, is pretty egregious as well.
Well, and I think at least locally, there's a fair amount of support when it comes to patent reform about opening regional offices, places where there could be more direct interaction, and I'm sure you'll hear more about
that. I have
to
say some concern about that, since the PTO is located in Alexandria, Virginia. So, but no, I concur.
You do need it. Okay. Hey, so, Weili, talk a little bit about just the patent issue for your company.
Well, we are definitely not lacking of innovators. I mean, nothing biased, but my husband, also one of the co-founder, he spent a lot of time invent. So he actually filed a lot of patents. A few years ago, he got the so-called the innovator of the year for as a CEO of the company. So I think. Absolutely, I agree. I think intellectual property protection is very, very important. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. We do a lot of patent at Marvell.
Thank you. Here's a question from the audience to you, Senator Warner. You talked a little bit about the Valley needs to invest in politics. Could you expand a little bit on that? What is it that the Valley is shying away from that is so important?
I think that... And I would say this, not just the Valley, but the tech community has generally had the view of, government get out of our way, but for the fact that without government invested in ARPA and DARPA, there would have never been, without government R&D, there wouldn't have been something. So I think the notion of investing in elected officials who are rational and that can read a balance sheet would be a great step forward, and not being episodic, which means you blow hot on one issue. There was a issue last year that was near and dear to my former job, heart, and probably to some in this room, where the Congress was looking at re-examining the tax treatment for carried interests. There wasn't a person in Silicon Valley that wasn't on my doorstep. but once that threat passed, and you need to have appropriate tax treatment for folks to take early stage risk, but folks kind of disappeared. The business community, again, writ large, needs to stay involved in the political process, because we're going to be forced. This is not the subject of tonight, but it is not a question in our country of whether we are going to deal with our deficit. It is only going to be a question of when. Are we going to do it on our timetable, or are we going to wait until the markets dictate to us? And we will only solve this with some extraordinarily hard choices and some level of shared sacrifice from everyone. And particularly this community that has benefited so much from the kind of investments and innovation. And while we've got problems with our education system, still our percentage of graduates and so forth versus the Chinas and Indias where people are not even got to high school, we've still got an enormous number of assets. But it is going to take all of us in the game.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Rob, we couldn't get out of this discussion, I don't think, without some discussion of U.S. corporate tax code and reform there. And we've talked a little bit about R&D and touched on it. What do you think are the three things that really need to be done, if you had a magic wand, that could really help stimulate and get us back to the innovation leader?
Well, I'm a kind of a contrarian, if you haven't been able to tell by now. And so my contrarian notion is I really think simplicity is way, way overvalued. there are people who pushed in the last administration, luckily there were other people in the administration, in the Bush administration who opposed this, to we want to simplify the tax code, so one way we're going to do it is we're going to get rid of the R&D tax credit. That, to me, is not the right approach to take. We've got to do two main things. I don't know about the three. We've got to do two main things on the corporate tax. One is we have to lower the effective rate. For the first time in history, the non-U.S. OECD, so in other words, the 29 other OECD countries other than the U.S., for the first time in history, their combined rate corporate tax is under 30%. Our combined state-federal rate, take all the average of the states, put the feds on top, is 39%. So you look at countries like, it's not just Ireland, it's France, it's Sweden, all of these countries that we think of as big government, high tax states have been lowering their corporate tax rate because they want to be effective. Right now, the French just put in place 2 years ago the highest R&D tax credit in the world. Actually, now Australia is the highest. There's all this competition to do R&D tax credit now. But to meet the French credit, if we wanted to meet the French credit, our credit would have to go up 4.5 times bigger than what it is today. So we have got to do a better job to lower taxes because we're in competition. But I would argue, rather than simplicity, what we really need the tax code to do, and this is contrary to what a lot of people in Washington think, but we need the tax code to drive innovation. So I really support the president, for example, on this last tax proposal, which was to expand the R&D credit and to also allow first-year expensing of CapEx. We need to make CapEx expensing, in my view, permanent. That would be a way to drive and give incentives to companies to invest here in America, and not as much overseas.
Okay. I agree with Rob's general premise. I disagree a little bit, though, that while our published rate is 35 or all added in 39, there's no company around that pays that rate. Our effective rate is about 28, and for certain companies, through taking advantage of code, is actually lower than the OECD average, about 22. So, you know, the thing that we have to do is I agree we ought to lower our rates, and I firmly believe in the R&D tax credit and fought to try to raise it and make it permanent. But there will have to be closing down some of these things in somewhat of a revenue neutral basis. You know, Ireland, I put a company in Ireland. I took advantage of that years ago, that 10% tax rate. Their long-term safety net was not sustainable on that tax basis. And one of the things that was, again, you mentioned what can the Valley do. I had a series of tech leaders in before the kind of debate about the tax cuts that took place in December. And, you know, the president and the Congress, we all got kind of high-fived by the American public, which I appreciate as a politician. Although, as somebody can read a balance sheet, what we did was we gave away $900 billion and added to the deficit for two years. And one of the challenges I had with some of our tech community friends said, I'm willing to take these fights on raising the R&D tax credit, making it permanent, and trying to make sure we structure an innovation. But I said this is to them, including myself in this, we then shouldn't complain if our individual rates go back up to where they were under President Clinton and President Bush, 41, when actually we had a lot of good things going. So there has to be, again, this sense of everybody in it, or we will not kind of get the tax code and the business climate right.
Okay, so let me follow up with a specific question on foreign earnings. There's a trillion two, that's sitting offshore and not coming back to be invested. The tax rate is 35%. It sounds like you took advantage of that with Nextel.
Not Nextel, different company.
Different company, okay. But you took advantage of it. And so there's continued pressure to figure out a way to bring some of that money back into the United States to spend.
I voted for repatriation this past year. I think we have to do it in a way that ties it to investment and job growth. That is easy to do in some industries. It's harder to do in others, mm-hmm. like pharma and elsewhere. So how we have a kind of a meaningful hook to this repatriation. And I would even go further and say that while not technically one-time revenue, I might use this the one-time revenue at whatever rate. You know, the bid and the ask is 35 okay. versus 5, whatever number you tie at. And it could be tiered based upon how much reinvestment and job creation. We could use some of that as a single-purpose vehicle to create a major infrastructure investment bank or energy bank. Mm-hmm. because we've not touched on those subjects today in terms of infrastructure and energy, two areas where, again, we need to make, I think, substantial potential for growth.
Okay, thank you. Wei-Li, I want to make sure you get an opportunity to weigh in on this since you and your husband get to write the checks to the government.
Very happy.
Well, what are some areas there of corporate tax reform that would be beneficial
for
your company?
You know, what Senator covered everything. I was listening to him, his remarks. This is a difference between pure politician and a politician, the leaders that have done business and, you know, founded his own company. Because just like company, country should measure by result-driven. Everything should be result-driven, right? Mm-hmm. Tax or doesn't matter anything we measure. It should be, you know, reward based on their performance. Right? And anything times zero is zero. If business is not successful, it's even a moot point to talk about tax. So I think he already covered everything. I agree with everything he said. So
terrific. We like agreement. Thank you very much, then. Here's a question from the audience. DARPA used to lead, and now they trail behind. Can the greatest innovation engine ever be restarted? And I'm not sure who might want to take a crack at that. How about you, Rob?
There's a colleague of ours at Carnegie Mellon, a professor there in public policy and engineering named Erica Fuchs. And Erica wrote probably one of the best papers on DARPA, studies on DARPA that's been done in this decade. It's actually linked on our website. We did an event with her on it. And what she did is she looked at the historical role of DARPA throughout the decades. And what she found was that in the last decade, DARPA has done somewhat what many corporations have done. So they've shifted their portfolio away from bigger, higher risk, earlier stage, more blue sky research into much more related to individual projects that the various services needed right away. Now, I'm not in the military. I don't know. Maybe that was the right choice for the military at that time. But the end result of it was that DARPA became less of sort of rocket fuel for the U.S. economy. And I think ultimately we can't really afford to do that. DARPA has played a critical role historically, and I think that's part of the reason we didn't do as well, many reasons. So I don't see any reason DARPA can't refocus. According to Erica's work, this is a little bit of a cycle in DARPA. They kind of go back and forth between short-term and long-term a little bit. I don't see any reason why they can't do that. They may be doing that now under the current administration. I'm just not aware of it. But I think DARPA can be refocused and become an engine. And the other big engine we now have, potentially, is ARPA-E, which is exactly the same model. Arun is the head of it and a great leader of that. But, you know, we're in a position now where we may actually zero out ARPA-E. I mean, it's sort of astounding when you think about it. Here we know that this is a critical technology for our nation. We know that climate change and energy independence are critical. We know that innovation has to play the key role in that. We know that ARPA-E is a good program. It's effective. And yet we're going to say, well, maybe we can't even afford it. So I don't think that's going to happen, but it certainly has been talked about.
Great. Thank you. We're getting short on time, and so I want to get in a couple more questions. The next one for you, Senator. What role should public policy play in helping restore America's innovation? For instance, energy policy has obviously been a very driving force in solar innovation and competition, and you mentioned several other things. But how does public policy play a good role?
I think public policy plays a role in basic research, mm-hmm. as kind of a funder of things that that even a venture or corporate wouldn't fund. I think it plays a role, particularly around the energy space, as a kind of first investor or basic purchaser of goods. And I think, again, echoing Rob, that the interesting thing around climate is that how that kind of scientific consensus seemed to have kind of won the day, but yet now if you take and talk to most Americans, they have an absolutely opposite view. And it's pretty stunning. It's one of the reasons why this ought to be more focused around energy independence, and quite candidly, I still think energy will be one of the greatest job and wealth creators in the next 25 years. And, you know, again, not saying everything vis-a-vis China, but China will probably never sign a climate accord, yet they are making those investments in solar and wind and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And we ought to be a little broader. I, for one, believe it ought to be a more portfolio approach around energy that includes things like nuclear, that includes even some continued use of domestic gas and oil as a transition, but, you know, have it all out there. On, again, as Waylee suggested, with a whole portfolio and measured based on performance. I think government can also, as I mentioned, some of these things around the edges that that don't always get a lot of attention, whether it's the FDA, whether it's the PTO, whether it's the fact that we are years behind countries like South Korea in terms of spectrum mm-hmm. deployment. Mm-hmm. If we're going to have the kind of mobile broadband capability, we have to do a better job of allocating spectrum and, for that matter, looking at some of the incumbents and maybe urging them to repackage some of that spectrum and make more available. Other countries have actually taken a great leap ahead of us in that. But those are some of the areas.
Okay. And thank you very much for that. We did have a couple of questions about broadband and also just about how do we get the kind of access you get in Korea and some other countries. Do you have anything else to add?
Well, part of it is spectrum.
Yeah.
And making sure that that is made available. And since it can become now a revenue source, since you can auction the spectrum off,
right.
You know, and one of the things I have legislation going forward would be basically give some of the incumbents who've got this a share of the proceeds to kind of urge them to go ahead and move forward. And one thing, let me mention, it was Rob's idea, and I and a series of senators were proud to add this recently to legislation. Basically said, America's got to have a national competitive strategy. And when we pass the America Competes Act, it has a component in it that will include a public-private group of folks to lay out an absolute strategy for this country. The last time something like this was done was actually during the early years of President Reagan, and out of that came the R&D tax credit. Out of that came new tech transfer policies from the university into the private sector, and a whole series of new federal R&D. So, Rob's idea, I think, will be put to task, and we've got to make sure that strategy doesn't end up on a shelf.
Great. Thank you. And we're down to our last question, and it needs to be kind of a lightning round when it comes to answers. And I'm going to personalize it a little bit to make it easy for you. What is your favorite technology-enabled device? And Waylee, why don't we start with you?
Oh.
What can't you do without?
Well, guess what? Now, these days is the little pal, the mobile pal that we carry every day, right?
Uh-huh.
Every second, you know.
Okay.
Like right now, it's very lonely, you know, in my bag. and everybody said, turn off. I actually kept
it. We like the way you personalized
it. Guess what? I did not turn off. I kept it vibrant because I didn't want to miss anything. So,
Rob, how about you? What's your
I think it's that thing you press the button and you can find your keys. That's my favorite device, or my wife's favorite device. Yeah. I actually think my favorite device nowadays is Skype on my computer, because I can talk to my son who's away for gap year before college, and we now see him. My 4-year-old daughter won't talk to him on the phone, but she loves talking to him on the computer, and it's just, to me, it's like, what a wonderful thing, and it's free and it's pretty good, and you know, couldn't do that just a few years ago.
Great, Senator.
I got to stick with. What got me here? The cell phone.
All right. Thank you very much. I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program. It's brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Senator Mark Warner, Rob Atkinson, founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, and Waylee Dai, co-founder of Marvell Technology Group, and to all of you for joining us. And now, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
This was great. Thanks.